flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
There's one thing that will forever change the way you sleep, and it's the softest, 100% organic cotton bedding from Boll & Branch. You'll fall asleep faster, wrapped in the most luxurious comfort. You'll never sleep hot again with airy blankets, cloud-like duvets, and breathable sheets. You'll experience pure comfort on night one and feel your bedding get softer with every wash. Discover the difference with 15% off your first order at BollAndBranch.com with code ODYSSEY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. A few minutes past 2 p.m. Coming up at 2:30, we have actor-director Austin Pendleton. If you don't know the name, Google him. You know the actor. He's been in a million things. He's one of my favorite comedic actors, although he's done a ton of drama. And he's going to be in studio to visit with us at 2:30. He's in town directing a play and putting on acting classes, so really looking forward to that. Bob Tewksbury is going to be with us, former Cardinal, at 4 p.m. That's always a lot of fun.
My fantasy camp manager.
Yeah, Bob's great.
Oh, dude, he's super smart. He's a mental skills coach.
Yes.
In professionals. I think he's with the Cubs now, but he's worked for the Red Sox, the Cubs. They used to call them sports psychologists,
yes,
but now it's a little bit different job in mental skills, just helping guys handle.
He was probably on the cutting edge of the new wave of
that. Oh, absolutely. And he's a perfect guy for it because he's a former player.
Yes.
You know, somebody that has both the training in the field of mental skills and how to do things the right way, and also mm-hmm. having experienced what it's like to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great guy, and he's hilarious too.
Time for Razor's Edge, and I'm just going to point out that Rachel's hair grew 8 inches while she was in Japan.
I appreciate that so much, because you know, I cut my hair off last year. I did, and as soon as I did it, I was like, why did I do this? Because I've had short hair in the past, and mm-hmm. it was cute, but then I did it again, expecting the same results, and it just didn't hit, and I wanted my long hair back, and now I'm kind of, it's below the shoulders again, and I can breathe a sigh of relief. I've just always had long hair.
How quickly did you regret it?
Immediately. I would wake up in the middle of the night and be like, what did I do? Mm. Like, what did I do? Because I went so short. It's the shortest I've ever. It was like above my chin.
Yeah.
It was really short. So, but I've been taking like these, I call them my hair gummies, but they're like biotin mm-hmm. gummies that I take every day.
It's working.
Yeah, thanks. I honestly really appreciate you saying something. Because at the beginning
good.
Of the show, Dave was like, your hair is super long. I'm like, yes.
I remember, I'll never forget the day you came in, because, you know, we have each other's confidence, and she's like, Kurt says I look like Johnny Depp and Willy Wonka, and I was like,
"Well,
wow."
I don't think that he came out and said it. I think I was doing the thing where I'm like, do I look like Johnny Depp?
Oh, I got you.
And he's not one to lie. He's...
That's a good thing. You want
he's
honesty.
He's not one to make you feel any better if you're fishing
for
a compliment.
You know where you stand with Kurt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He's very. He really reminds me of Trish, like the way you were talking about her in the last hour.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is they have the same birthday.
That's right.
Look at that.
They have
maybe
similar personalities.
Maybe it's part of their
the caller outers. Yeah. The direct people.
A couple of Leos.
What you got for the edge?
Okay, so I just want a ruling on whether or not something is ethical. Hmm. And I got to thinking about this because I feel like I've kind of brushed up against this sort of thing before. I can't think of a specific instance, but I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were talking about the fact that there was like this sushi restaurant in New York where there was a error on their DoorDash, Uber Eats, whatever it was, to where you could get like 20 pieces of sushi for a couple of bucks and it was really good sushi. So they would just keep doing it all the time and taking advantage of this. And it was the kind of thing where it was like an obvious mistake because why would they be charging so little for this? It was just an oversight by the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And my question for you guys is like, would you feel bad taking advantage of something like that, or would you be like, hey, it's their fault?
I see it both ways, but personally, I've been kicked in the ass so many times by karma.
Yeah.
I try not to tempt it anymore. Yeah, so I would come clean. I wouldn't take advantage of it.
What about you, Wheels?
I mean, I might the first time, because you might look at that and think, oh, it's just because they want you to like their food and you'll come back and pay full price in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would go back over and over again for something along those lines. But like if, I don't know, if a store accidentally, like if Amazon accidentally charged me $10 instead of $30, I wouldn't be worried about it. I'm like, all right, you're Amazon. Mom and pop store, though, I probably point it out. Maybe that's a weird...
No, I don't think that's weird.
...line, because I'll cheat these guys, but I won't cheat these guys.
Well, I don't think that is weird.
It's not
though,
cheating,
because,
but you know what I mean.
Yeah, because those big companies, you know, you would think would have plenty of people auditing their prices and, like, noticing, okay, why did we sell, you know,
what's your
200...
number? What's your number that you would feel compelled to point something out? Say, for example, you go to buy a car. And it's $30,000, and you negotiate and you agree on $30,000, and then when they bring you your contract, it's $29,500, and they've clearly made a mistake. Like, what's your number where you go,
where you let it slide, or where you say something?
Both ways.
Mm. Kind of depends on who's bearing that, right? Like, if I know the person. Let's say it's my sales guy that I've been dealing with, and he's been, you know, helping me out. And it might get him in trouble, or it might cost him his commission. I would say something. I'd be like, hey, you might want to double check that. But if it was something like, again, well, that's just going to be that much less for General Motors. Well, fine, they can handle not getting my extra $500. You know, I mean, like, I think that's the hard part is mm-hmm. who's it impacting? You know, as an example, like you think of it more of as a restaurant, right? If you go to a place and if somebody as a former server, there was a once or twice where I screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ended up paying for that
because
it was my fault. And if it were that case, I'm definitely going to say, hey, you might want to double check. But again, if it's just a big company that's going to eat it, I mean, they don't do things with me in their mind. You know,
yeah.
They're not like, you know, we're going to look out for every one of those people and make sure everything's just right for them.
Yeah. If you left a $100 tip on a $50 meal, I doubt anyone's chasing you out the door and saying, I think you left me too much money.
No. And in that case, it's an intentional move
mm-hmm.
versus a mistake. But yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other question is, do you think you have a responsibility as a customer? Does the customer have that responsibility to check the price, or is it like you're the one providing the bill?
Only to themselves.
Yeah.
Like I said, I wouldn't do it because it would eat at me, but no, I don't think you owe a company. And I agree with you guys. It may be a false equivalency, but I would feel less about taking money from Boeing than I would from, you know, Joe's Garage.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's just who's got the greater margin for error? Right. I mean, and by the way, again, I know that there's a bias in my case. I have a bias against Bigger, mostly because, again, Bigger doesn't care about me. I think, you know, Joe, who owns the garage, I probably know Joe. You know, I probably talk to Joe. He might be a guy that I like. And that does impact it versus somebody who I think if they were ruling on something involving me would not rule in my favor just because they think that's the right thing to do.
Okay, the other thing I wanted to talk about, I'm sorry I bring up AI all the time, but I'm kind of obsessed with it.
Okay.
And there's a new story every day.
Mm-hmm.
So there were these people, they were posting on Reddit and they were saying, yeah, I was on Meta, I was on Facebook and Instagram, and I used AI to edit one of my photos, right? Then later I log on to Instagram and they were using my face in an AI ad targeted at me. So I guess the PSA out there is if you use artificial intelligence on any of these sites, there's probably a little disclaimer in there.
Yeah,
that's
read
like,
the terms.
Yeah, it's like, by the way, we can use your face. But what I want to talk about is how bizarre is that to see yourself in an ad? And where does that end? Where does, you know, Dave, just picture the kind of emotional manipulation, the like, okay, you see like the... what is it, the Sarah McLachlan puppy commercials. Well, imagine if they were able to do something like that sad, and then they could use your child's face in the ad to manipulate you and get you to spend money. I mean, it's just, it feels like a slippery slope and super weird.
I've had people use my face a lot.
Really?
Yeah. Like just
like former clients or
former clients, that never bothers me that much. Like, okay, you paid us for a while, but I've had businesses just go like, it's the Dave Glover burger.
Like, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Dave's no, like, I've never heard of this restaurant before.
That's interesting though. I've never thought of that. Like targeted ads that have your puppy
right
starving and shaking and shivering. Yeah.
Just kind of messed up to think about. And
it's
where,
like Minority
where
Report.
End?
Yeah. Hey, can we do an audio? Do you have my audio?
Yes.
Okay. So this is Pamela Brown from CNN interviewing this congressman who, I said that weird, who
Congressman
wants to take away kids' free lunches because he had to work since he was 13 and they can go work at McDonald's. And if not, they're just going to stay on welfare their whole life.
Right now with this freeze, vulnerable populations could be directly impacted. And so my question to you, just to follow up with you, would you support getting rid of, you know, school lunch for vulnerable kids and breakfast and Head Start, for example, and getting rid of childhood cancer research? Do you support that? And what do you say to your constituents? I want to follow up on that question, too, because I didn't hear an answer from you.
When you talk about school lunches, hey, I worked my way through high school. I don't know about you, but I worked since I was, before I was even 13 years old, I was picking berries in the field before we had child labor laws that precluded that. I was a paper boy. And when I was in high school, I worked my entire way through. You're telling me that kids who stay at home, instead of going to work at Burger King, McDonald's during the summer, should stay at home and get their free lunch instead of going to work? I think we need to have a top-down review.
I think
review.
You're painting
think
a lot of these kids with a broad
to
brush. I would say that's not necessarily
exactly
a fair assessment of all of the kids. So you would say all the kids in your district who use the free lunch, for example, or breakfast, they're all just sitting at home and not working. Okay, I just want to clarify because that seems like what you were trying to insinuate.
No, this gives us a chance. No, this gives us a chance, though, to see where is the money really being spent? Who can actually go and actually produce their own income? Who can actually go out there and do something that makes them have value and work skills for the future? I mean, how many people got their start in fast food restaurants when they were kids?
Thoughts?
I mean, they're children. It's not like it's a group of adults that have access to a bus route or a car or a way of getting to work. I mean, just because you worked picking berries in the field at 13, that job opportunity is not going to be available to all 13-year-olds out there. They don't have the resources to go and work for themselves. So not only are they being let down by their parents, now they're being let down by the school that was prior, like, I mean, I hate to say like their parents are letting them, but it's like there's a need there that's not being filled.
Yes.
And you're willing to say like, well, you just need to go out and work. These kids are obviously in a situation that's already very vulnerable. It's just very callous to be like, you got to get out there and work. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that's what you want from everyone in society is to be contributing to society and working. And in a perfect world, absolutely no one would be taking government benefits because there wouldn't be a need for that. But there is a need. And I just think it's very disingenuous to be like, well, since I had to do it, I don't want to help anyone else out in present day.
I mean, the idea that kids should have to work to feed themselves is ridiculous. That's ridiculous. It's one thing to say if you're 15, you should have a side job and you can pay for things like you want to go out with your friends. All right, I get you. But if we're like saying, with a blanket, because when we're talking about the school lunch things, they're not all high school kids. Some of these are 8-year-old kids. Yeah. What are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a guy that had a paper route when he's, okay, great. How much money did you make on your paper route? Were you feeding yourself off of that? Were you getting yourself lunch
for that
every day?
You said it perfectly. It's one thing for a child to have a part-time job, make extra money. That's great. I did it. Most of us did it. But a child should not have to work to feed themselves.
Yeah.
Full stop.
When a kid has a paper route, that's not necessarily with the goal of making them self-sufficient
right
in a society.
Yeah, that should never be. They're children. There's a reason why we have laws that protect children, because they're not expected to support themselves and to be like a functioning member of society. They're under either their parents or the government's protection.
Yeah. There are things you can't do as a child.
Yeah.
So you have laws that constrain you, and you have laws that support you. And I don't think we should take the ones away that support you and keep the ones that constrain you.
Yeah. I mean, again, he grew up in a rural area, somewhat rural. Well, I mean, going out and picking berries isn't an option for a kid in Atlanta. You know, I mean, like, it's not an option for a kid that's in the city in Atlanta. What's he going to do? What are they going to do?
Yeah, later on in the
interview. I'm talking little kids, right? When you're 10, you can't even actually work.
Later on in the interview, he says that kids who get free lunches end up on welfare their whole lives, which
nonsense.
I think is a ridiculous blanket statement.
It's nonsense.
You just don't help anyone because they'll never stop wanting help, right?
There you go.
If we're going to help anybody, help kids. Right. They're the ones that need the help.
Yes. This testosterone shot's making you smarter.
Dude, I know. I can't wait, man. Wait for like 3 weeks.
224 DGS on KMOX. Just met Austin Pendleton, who I'm a big fan of. He's a comedic and dramatic actor. If you Google him, you'll go, oh my God, I love this guy. He's so nice. I'm so excited to have him on.
Yeah. Very cool.
Just a real gentleman.
We need some nice in this room.
We do.
Almost got him.
Yeah, I think you did get me. You know, I can tell I'm getting older. Things look attractive to me that never have.
Like what?
Like RVs. I saw an ad today. Like Apache Village was really good to me when Nick and I were competing in the barbecue competitions when he was like 13. They'd give us this Bon Jovi tour bus to go to Hannibal, Missouri and make barbecue. And so I dig them. They're fun. But I never thought like, oh, I should buy one of these things. I saw an ad today and I'm like, that looks pretty good. Just sitting out on the open road.
They're so cool. I would love an RV. Oh.
Yeah. You and I could just go do the country.
There we go.
Mm.
There's a reality show for you.
Yeah.
Like, remember, who did that? It was Paris Hilton and
Nicole Richie.
Yeah, we could be the modern version of that.
We could be the simple life.
Just two hot girls
That's
on
it.
The road.
That's it. A couple of hotties going through the Dakotas.
We briefly entertained that. Do you remember? We briefly entertained that we would do like a cross-country walk of some kind.
That was my worst idea ever.
A cross-country walk?
It didn't make a lot of sense.
That's a terrible idea.
That's back when Close was on the show, and I wanted the four of us to walk the Katy Trail. And we would walk all day, and then we would stop at a little town, and we would do the show. Which seemed such a great idea at the time. And everyone was like, that's...
Like one or the other. Like, we could travel up the trail and do the show, or walk and then not do the show.
So you guys should have given me that idea.
Both sounds a little tough. And didn't it come from Close saying like he could easily walk the Katy Trail without?
He was always making some brag.
Breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
It would be like nothing to him.
Oh, by the way, I received a message today from our very good friend, Craig Lombardi.
Mm-hmm.
And Craig is running for mayor of Godfrey.
Oh, cool.
And asked me to do a little video for him, which I, of course, agreed to because he's like my brother. But how cool is that?
That is cool. I'm voting for him.
Are you in Godfrey?
Yep.
I think he's going to be the mayor of Godfrey.
I'm voting for him.
You know what that means? I can kill a guy in Godfrey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You got sway.
No more speeding tickets in Godfrey, I'll tell you that much.
Dave gets pulled over in Godfrey, like, do you know who I am?
Just call Craig.
Just call Craig.
They'll be like, yes, we do. We saw the
video. In fact, what you'll probably get is like they'll just put your car on the list of do not bother, and you'll just never get pulled over.
Is there a list like that?
I don't know.
That'd be nice.
I just make it stuff up.
Man, one time I had hosted the birthday party for the Marine Corps downtown. And they did toast, and that's the only alcohol I had that night, but I'd had like a shot for a toast to the ladies. And I was driving home, and I got pulled over, and I was not even close to drunk, but I'd had alcohol in my breath. And the biggest cop I've ever seen walks up in my rearview mirror, and I roll my window down, I get out all my you know, documents, and the biggest hand, it was like a bunch of bananas, just comes through my window right at me, and I'm like, he's gonna pull me out of my car. And he just holds it there, and so I took it and he shook my hand and he said, I know who you are and I know where you were tonight, and I just want to thank you. Isn't that great?
Nice. Oh,
And my heart was beating out of my chest.
I picture you took his hand, not like a shaking it, but like this, just like a gentle.
Like, oh, like Curious George and the man in the yellow hat.
Grasping
he kisses
of it,
his
like,
hand like,
like, I hope you're not going to
help me, George.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, I'm Dave Glover Show on KMOX. So we have a very active theater community here in St. Louis, and A Long Day's Journey in Tonight by Eugene O'Neill is being put on at the Gaslight Theater, and it's going to be February the 7th through the 23rd, and I'm going to go see this. I'm very excited about it. We have the star, William Roth, is here with us. We have the director, Austin Pendleton, and as I said, if you don't know Austin's name, Google him. You know Austin. He's been in everything. I grew up watching all the movies with Austin. It's a pleasure to meet you guys. Austin, pleasure to have you on KMOX.
Thank you. Thank you.
William, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. So, Austin, tell us about this project.
Well, I've always wanted to direct this play. Ever since I was a teenager, which was a very long time ago. And so when this offer came, I just simply grabbed it.
That's fantastic. Do you have much of a connection to St. Louis? Have you been through town much in your career?
A little bit. I used to come down here and teach. When I was up in Chicago, I'm a member of a company in Chicago called the Steppenwolf.
Oh my gosh! Oh, yeah. I love Steppenwolf.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they would invite me down here to teach.
That was... Were you in from the beginning, like with Gary when he set it up, or did you get on later?
I was just a few years after that. It was still a small company at that time.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place.
Oh, it's a wonderful place.
What great work they've done over the decades.
Yeah.
William, how about you?
What about
this project?
St. Louis Actors Studio is a theater that I founded 17 years ago. I met Austin about 12 years ago in his class at HB Studios in New York, and we became friends. He was going to play King Lear for us. I'm the one who would bring him down from Steppenwolf to teach master classes, which he has done this time as well on Saturdays. And I would always look for something for him to direct, but he's so darn busy. And somehow, I mean, I had this in the season and I mentioned it to him, and I found a project he'd never directed before.
That's great.
Which is amazing. So he said yes, and here he is.
Austin, how early in your career did you start directing?
First of all, when I was a kid, there was a whole bunch of us. We would put on plays and I would direct some of those, but perhaps that doesn't count. I worked at the Williamstown Summer Theater, and that had this wonderful Greek artistic director by the name of Nikos, and he got me directing there. And the first show I directed was Tartuffe, and then 3 years later I directed Uncle Vanya, and Uncle Vanya went very well, and that was the one that opened the doors to all the New York directing that I've done.
I know you teach master classes on this, and I apologize for the ham-fisted question, but what is the real key to directing for you? If you picked up, if someone said, I want to be a director, give me one piece of advice.
Watch. Watch what they're doing. And try and... You have an overall idea what you want, but watch and see how they fit in. And sometimes they really open your eyes up to other possibilities within the concept that you have. Mm-hmm. But there was a great director that I met by the name of Gene Sachs. Mm-hmm. He was married to Beatrice Arthur, who I was with in Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know Gene, and I said, Gene, they've asked me to direct my first show. What should I? He said, you should just have to listen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. You listen. You watch and you listen. You have a concept, but you don't close your mind to anything outside that concept. You find things, even things outside that concept, that surprise you in the way they would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
So you have and I also had the honor to know Elia Kazan, and he would say the same thing. Look, pay attention, Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Look what's happening in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't close your eyes to things you might not have considered a possibility.
Yeah. Well, and what's your advice? Someone like me, I was a lawyer, and then I've been in radio and stand-up comedy and such for 25 years. I've always wanted to act. When I was in high school, I was definitely nerdy enough to be an actor, but I was too afraid to do it. And then my senior year, they put on Grease and all the jocks were in it. And I was like, son of a bitch, right? Like, I could have done this the whole time. Yeah, I was just too worried about it. I could have been a contender.
Right.
Yeah,
for someone,
right.
I just turned 60,
mm-hmm.
so I'm viewing my life differently now. For someone like me that would like to do it, what's your best advice here in St. Louis for people who'd like to get involved?
Well, I mean, certainly your timeline is shorter than some of the younger actors that are starting out. Right? I'm 61. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So in every case, there's so many different levels of theater happening in St. Louis. It doesn't mean that you have to like take classes and study for X amount of years and then audition. COCA, there's a bunch of places to take acting classes, acting one, fundamental classes. There's people that do private lessons, but just go out and audition. If there's a play that you've always wanted to be in, but you've never acted before, the worst that can happen is what happens to us 90% of the time, and that is you don't get cast. So you don't have to be a novice to lose out.
Question to both of you. Austin, you first. Obviously, you can get better at your craft for your whole life.
Yeah.
How many people have you come across who you go, these people are just naturals. They can just do it.
Well, actually, what you begin to learn is that you start to assume they have possibilities, because sometimes it's very surprising. I mean, I teach, and somebody comes into the class, and I think, oh, I don't know. And then 3 weeks later, they knock you out. So the trick is to try to get them so relaxed that they will open. I mean, not relaxed in a passive sense, but actively relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And then just things start to open up.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep your eye on them, saying, I know there's something there. What's the key that's going to turn in the lock?
Mm-hmm. I see a lot of comedians who go into movies, and they just seem, it's not that hard for them. You know what I mean? Like, they just... And I've even seen some of them interviewed, and they're like, yeah, I just kind of did it. Makes you jealous.
Yeah, I guess so. But if you've been on a movie set, you get about 1,000 chances to pull off a scene.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
so,
which I've never been.
There's a good director and a good budget. You know, you can pull a performance out of just about anybody.
So tell us about this production. Tell us about, I'm familiar with this play. I've never seen it done. Mm-hmm. So this will be my first. But tell us about Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Well, most people will know it from Jessica Lange, who perfected the role of Mary, I believe. I saw her in New York. So she's done it most recently. It doesn't get done as much as it used to, but it's an American classic. Eugene O'Neill is the finest of playwrights from the 20th century. It's his autobiographic grand opus. It is what he wrote about his family, what he did live through. And once he finished writing it, he had it locked up at Random House's safe and said, don't publish it until 25 years after my death. He died and his wife had it published immediately because she understood that it needed to be seen. And it was and has been since recognized as one of the greatest plays ever written. It won the Tony and the Pulitzer and it continues to do it. It is takes place in the early 1900s, but it's accessible and the language is just amazing and poetic and the story is gripping and funny and tragic.
So, Austin, your first time directing. Have you played in this play before? Have you acted?
No, there isn't really a part for me. Yeah.
Who is some of your favorite directors who you worked with?
Me?
Who directed you?
Jerome Robbins. He's sort of responsible for my career. And Alan Arkin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, got a lot of them. You know, Dan Sullivan is very good. Oh, got a lot. Oh, and the guy up at Williamstown.
Mm-hmm. I know you get this question all the time, but any of your roles that we've seen you in movies over the decades that stands out to you, or do you think, I really was especially good in this, or I really had fun with this one? What would you look back over your past?
Well, there's a very underrated movie I was in called Trial and Error with the guy who played Kramer in Seinfeld.
Yeah.
and that wonderful actress who later won the Academy Award for Charlene Theron. She's in it, and I'm very fond of that movie. I don't know why it isn't more well known.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed by the director who directed My Cousin Vinny, which was a smash. And for some reason, the studio just decided not to publicize it. Hmm. It's so capricious, this industry.
Yeah,
there's no reason they couldn't have promoted that movie. But anyway, Trial and Error is one of my favorite. Another one was filmed one afternoon. I mean, the scene I had with Joanne Woodward in Kansas City. Mr. and Mrs. Bridge.
Yes.
With Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Yes.
That's one of my favorites. That afternoon filming with the big scene I had with Joanne is one of my happiest memories. And
you directed Elizabeth Taylor?
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke?
Yeah.
That must have been amazing.
Yes, it was. Elizabeth Taylor, she'd never been in a play before. Because she became a child star. So she was never in a school play or, you know, anything like that. First time she was ever in a play. But when I was offered it, I thought, well, she probably has an aptitude for it because a whole lot of her best work on film had been films adapted from plays. So she knew that way of thinking.
Yes. Yes.
She stepped right into it. She was a very generous lady with her time and her attention. She would throw parties for us.
Was she just unworldly beautiful in real life as well?
She was outrageously beautiful. But unselfconsciously, it was kind of amazing. She didn't flout it. She was very generous. And I've told the story to William a million times. So we were nominated for 5 Tonys, and we lost all of them, which is fine, you know. But she stood up at the after party, and she clicked, you know, on the glass with her fork. She says, I'm inviting tonight everyone in every category who lost to a party tomorrow night at 11 o'clock after the show on the second floor of Sardi's. It was one of those wonderful parties I've ever been to.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. That tale captures kind of an essence in her.
Yeah.
And the just spontaneous kind of generosity.
Yeah.
And the originality of that idea. Who has ever thrown a party for the losers?
Yeah.
And she turned them into winners.
That's great. I love hearing things like that. Humanizing people who are just bigger than life to us.
Yeah.
William, tell us about the Actor's Studio here in town.
It's a theater that I started out of the fact that I have a small graphic design firm that kind of helps keep all these things going. And I needed an office space and found a beautiful historic building on Boyle. And so I had this space next to it, and I've been an actor for 40 years, 20 years ago, I guess, 20. And this space was abandoned, and it was near Gaslight Square with all this history. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been an actor. Why not start a theater company and build a theater and see how I can go for it? And so we had a restaurant next door, the West End Girl and Pub, which is now the Black Mountain Wine House, which is a lovely spot. But the whole idea was, you know, culture, cuisine, cocktail, you know, you've got the culinary arts and the performing arts and the graphic arts all in the same little place. And we have been successfully making our way through for 18 years and having, luckily, John Hamm, Austin, a bunch of people have helped us over the years. And it's exciting work and a lot of fun.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Austin, are you looking forward to anything in particular while you're in St. Louis? Any restaurants or activities? Going to any games or anything like that?
No. I'm just totally, totally wrapped up in this play.
Just in the work.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, in the work. So this is Austin Pendleton and William Roth. The play is Long Day's Journey Tonight by Eugene O'Neill. It is at the Gaslight Theater, which is on Boyle in the West End. It is February 7th through the 23rd. I am absolutely going at least once, maybe a couple of times. Pleasure to meet you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Live radio. So Austin took a tumble right before we went on air. He sat down in the chair, and the chair rolls, and he's an older man, and he went ass over tea kettle.
Good recovery.
Great recovery.
Really interesting.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
I was about to break out some of my Elizabeth Taylor stories. Dude, that was fascinating. Because that's like, it's such a level,
right?
It
sounds made up.
No, I know, but like, she is... and people of that time who were big stars, it's just, I don't know, they feel like the godfathers of what came after.
Yeah. I'm forever jealous of people. I've been very fortunate to make my living in the past 25 years in the arts, music, radio, comedy. Incredibly fortunate. But someone like Austin, who's been doing this literally over 60 years and has been in, you know, probably 100 movies and 100 plays, and it's just fantastic. I don't know. I could talk to him all night.
Yeah, that was good. It's fascinating. It's a lot of work, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, memorize stuff.
That would be a problem for me.
Yeah, I mean,
I am forever impressed with people who can do that.
Rach and I were talking about it during the break, but like the point that William made about the difference between movies and stage.
Mm-hmm.
Like you mess up on stage, the whole world sees, ooh, and you mess up on film, it's like, cut, let's do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of like that cut part.
Yeah.
Of course, we do the live thing here. It's just that we're not scripted.
Right. Yes.
Right. It makes it a little easier.
Yeah.
It reminds me, I mean, it's nothing, it actually shouldn't remind me, but my only thing like that was when I did the Exorcism Live program on Discovery, and I was the backyard host. The attractive guy was in the front yard.
I love how they put you in different parts of the
yard. I was literally in the backyard. I had like a little console, these three girls that were from a paranormal group who were looking at screens that had nothing on them. You know, like they're like the mission control, yes. And they're just looking at blank screens.
Right,
like, oh, look at this, look at this.
They're in charge.
And when I was, they came to me for the job. I didn't have to audition or anything. And they said, can you read a teleprompter? Because you'll be on teleprompter. I'm like, I was born reading a teleprompter. You kidding me? I'd never even seen a teleprompter. And I show up for rehearsals, which was weird rehearsing a live show. And they turn on the teleprompter. And I start doing it, and I can't. And I stopped, and I said, guys, can I just, you know, it was like my actor moment. Can I just ad-lib and see how that works? And the director's like, oh, hey, ho, ho. I'm like, just give me one shot. And so thank God I did, and I kind of nailed it. And they're like, yeah, get rid of the teleprompter. Dave's fine. And other than that, I would have had to quit.
Those are your radio skills.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't read it and say it and seem the least bit natural. And I had been in Florida right before this, and I get tan like mahogany. And when I get tan, I get oily. Mm. So I looked like a recently varnished cello. And Tony Colombo was there with me. And the director, who is such a director, people, that kind of thing. And he was like, Tony Colombo. Get a towel for Dave's head.
He said both his names.
Yes.
Oh, he was like, Tony, do this.
He was just Tony Colombo.
That's
Tony
awesome.
Colombo, get a towel for Dave.
That's awesome.
Great. And then the famous scene was when I came around to the front because I was the first person to get into the Exorcist house. And the handsome host, he looked like Ryan Reynolds' brother who may have been kicked by a mule. And he was like, so Dave, tell me about being at the Exorcist house for the first time. And we rehearsed this a bunch of times. And so I would give my little 5-minute presentation and then we would fist bump, which made me feel so cool.
Especially when it's planned.
Yes. And that was it. And so I came out during the live show. I did my thing. I did it well, did what I wanted to do, fist bump, and then one of the directing assistants is doing this to me. Get off camera. So I just, like Pee Wee Herman in Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
You just start walking sideways.
I shuffled this way, and then someone else goes, get back in there. And so if you watch it on YouTube, you can see me go out of the shot, into the
You're
shot.
You're like doing a dance.
Out of the shot, into the shot.
That's
it
great.
Was terrible.
How come they aren't better at that? They should be able to be very clear.
I guess because it was live.
I don't know. I don't know, man. It shouldn't be that hard.
I was busy sweating and shining.
Yeah. Well, you shone like a star, dude.
Yeah, I shone. I watched it with the family. The Glovers are a tough audience. So here's Dad making his national television debut, and when that happened, the Pee Wee Herman thing, they were on the floor.
That's great.
They were just all on the floor.
That's not even your fault, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's entirely on the fault of the people that literally do that for a living.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, they should be more clear in what they're doing. I blame them.
I think when you're watching it just as a thing, I don't think it's, like, as noticeable.
We should post that.
But
we should find it.
It's on HBO Max, I believe.
Is it really?
Mm-hmm. Or Amazon Prime, one of those two, because I just watched it very recently. But it is very, when you know what you're looking for, it is very funny to see. Not really noticeable if you're not looking for it, but if you're looking for it, you're like,
it was so noticeable to me just because it was exactly like what Pee Wee Herman did.
Yeah.
Mr. Herman, paging Mr. Herman.
Well, also, those moments feel like an eternity when you're living them.
Yes.
Even though it's like two seconds, maybe.
It's a second and a half, but you're like living
your
a life
whole body
in there.
Just flop sweats, and you feel like you're gonna pass out or grab your nipples or something.
Oh no, that would actually be better.